Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. We are at the Reporters Roundtable tonight with the top stories of the week, and there is plenty to talk about. My guests are Charles Ellison, political commentator and publisher of The B-Note, Misha Green, D.C. editor of the Afro-American newspapers, and on deck tonight, Metro Rail safety, a big controversy there. D.C. police shootings, redistricting controversy in Prince George's County, and of course, the passing of Colin Powell. Lines are open. I want to hear what you have to say about these issues as well. We'll be taking them one at a time. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Charles, Misha, thank you both for joining the conversation.
Thank you for having us.
Right. Good to be with you.
So first, major safety failure for the massive DMV subway system. And now questions about what Metro officials knew about safety problems and why federal authorities were not told for years.
We were notified of that during this investigation. We were not notified prior to this investigation. We are fortunate that no fatalities or serious injuries occurred as a result of any of these derailments.
That's NTSB Chair Jennifer Homendy revealing that there have been 52 derailments of the new 7,000 series Metro trains since 2017. And Metro officials did not tell the NTSB about any of them. And of course, this comes after a derailment just last Tuesday. Misha, why haven't heads rolled since Monday? Why aren't people out of jobs? This is probably one of the most frightening things that we have seen related to controversies in the district since that big Metro crash, in 2009?
Yeah, so it is one of the biggest. Remember, that Metro collision in 2009 killed 9 people. So people should be outraged. That quote alone showed that it could have been far more catastrophic than it was. Luckily, no one was seriously injured. But the fact that they've known about wheel assembly issues since 2017 is a major problem. I think that right now, the reason why no one has lost their job yet is because there's a bit of a benefit to the fact that there are so many problems happening right now in Washington, D.C., and, of course, the world. And so it's been, for example, when I was listening to coverage of it and the issues on Monday morning, the breaking news of Colin Powell happened. And so I think that there are distractions stopping folks from protesting and getting out on the streets and sort of doing the things that would call further attention to the major harm that WMATA is putting Washington, D.C. residents in right now.
I think that people should be voting with their feet. Metro already having problems, even pre-COVID, with ridership numbers being down, and COVID hit, and then, of course, the trains in a great many cases virtually empty. But for something like this to happen, Charles,
right?
This is frightening to me. I mean, that statement by Homendy saying that, yeah, no one told us.
Right.
This wasn't just one. 52 derailments over 4 years, and somebody saying nobody told the federal authorities?
Right. You know, so it is frightening, right? And but it also goes back to something you just said a few moments ago, Harold, like the lack of outrage. There's no outrage. There's no outrage from policymakers, regional policymakers, state, local, and federal. No outrage from the public, because let's be real. And this is a problem that's emblematic of not just D.C. Metro. It's all major mass transit systems. And I say this as someone who grew up literally on a mass transit system in Philadelphia, one of the largest in the country, and we're having the same issue in Philadelphia. People, generally the public, tends to view mass transit as a poor people's system. And we've got to cut ourselves out of that mindset. Mass transit should be a central form of transportation, a central building block of infrastructure for any major urban area. But in D.C., and I've noticed this as someone who transplanted from Philly, came to D.C. to college 20-odd years ago, and I noticed, you know, like, D.C. was never a very mass transit-centric area or region, which
No.
is sad. It's always been like that. People are very car-centric, and that's sad for a number of reasons. One, you know, not everyone can afford a car, and so there are people who do, and see, we tend to forget about that constituency. There are thousands of people and millions of people nationwide every day who really need mass transit to get to and from work. And so, you know, that's one of the big issues with, you know, right now we're talking about how, oh, you don't want to give people too much more unemployment benefits or child tax credits because they're staying home from work. It's like, no, they can't afford their child care, and you're also underfunding mass transit systems and not allowing them to get to and from work, because how can they, on these low wages, afford a car? So we really have to crack, especially when we're in climate crisis mode, and we need to be driving less as a society, and in other places around the world they are. You know, D.C. really has to be a leader in this as the nation's capital and say, hey, you know what, we're going to make a commitment to drive less, to really make the kinds of necessary investments in Metro that are essential. But see, we're not doing that. And see, and Metro, that's why heads haven't rolled, because policymakers and people in charge of Metro, they know people aren't paying attention, and they know that they're always underfunding and underestimating what Metro could provide, what Metro could do.
But I would also argue that this is Nixonian in its scope. Misha, you're too young for that. But but you know, the question comes up: what did Paul Wiedefeld, the general manager, know, and when did he know it? Because, you know, they always say the fish stinks from the head down, and we have seen reports this week of staff, safety workers inside Metro who have known about these things but have been afraid to come forward because of a culture of fear. And that kind of thing, and Misha, that's not new. Culture of fear, whistleblowing, speaking up, speaking truth to power isn't something that is specific to Metro. We are seeing accusations of that in the police department, and we are seeing accusations of that in with I just got brain Facebook. You know, everybody's got this culture where you just keep your head down and hope that no one says anything to you about these problems. But we're talking life or death here, or the potential here. And I think that's where we're going to see a major problem with this.
Absolutely. You know, I think you make a great point about the fact that fear is one of the driving factors of people not saying anything. But, you know, I'd be curious to know how many lower sort of ranking employees have actually said something and it's been ignored. You know, the fact that wheel assembly issues have been known since 2017, I am just not convinced that the higher powers that be had no idea that there were some significant issues. On top of the fact that there have been issues, smaller incidents, of course, over the years,
mm-hmm.
flooding,
the smoke issue,
the smoke issues, the escalators stopping abruptly while people are on it. I mean, those things are all problematic and have not been addressed. And it really makes me go back to, I believe it was 2 years ago, and I think I was on your show talking about it, where there was a surplus of Metro funds because of ticketing people for hopping the trains with Metro. And, you know, I have no idea how funds are allotted. I'd have to do a little bit more research before speaking on that with confidence. However, if we had that surplus back in 2019 because we were ticketing people again, to you all's point, that really could not afford anything but public transportation, and we had a surplus because of that, why weren't we addressing these major issues? And up to the point now where 60% of the cars are now pulled. I mean, I think that's just absurd. And the fact that, again, people are distracted.
Yeah.
That is the reason why heads are not fully rolling.
And, of course, Metro announcing today that they want to offer $21 to those passengers who were on the train during the derailment last Tuesday, for their trouble. Ooh, man, talk about insult to injury. $21? That.
But, you know, once again, there's not a whole, from what I've known or noticed about the D.C. region, there's really not a whole lot of, like, vigorous advocacy like you have in other major cities for mass transit. So, you know, definitely we have pandemic going on. There's a lot of distractions, of course. But this dates back before pandemic. You know, people in the region are just not that interested in their mass transit system. And it could be much more of a world-class mass transit system and making the net. I mean, Americans, generally speaking, don't know that for every $1 billion of mass transit investment, the U.S. economy makes $5 billion. I mean, so you get a huge return on investment when you invest in your mass transit system. And so, you know, Metro is, you know, when you have that lack of investment, you're going to have that lack of creative, innovative talent and management to make the necessary changes and also look for other ways outside. I mean, right now, I think you have ridership accounts for about 40% of Metro's revenues. So that's a huge chunk of right now. I think Metro's dealing with $500 million deficit, and a lot of that from pandemic. But see, if you had that kind of investment in advocacy, you know, the policymakers and the public saying, hey, we really need this system. This is a core part of how we function as a region. And then, you know, also, you know, the policymakers are on the management, putting in the right creative people. You wouldn't have a lot. You wouldn't have half these problems, or you would have the management holding people accountable when these sorts of catastrophes happen.
Well, I think to your point, Charles, compared to New York, Chicago, and Philadelphia, for example, here in the East, Northeast, Metro is a relatively new system. It opened in 1976. I remember when it happened. It was a big deal. It was big and pretty and fancy and the whole bit.
Yeah, my uncle was one of those people who built it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the discussions that we were having in preparation today was, yeah, New York system may not be the cleanest. Chicago may not be the cleanest. Philadelphia may not be the cleanest. But those cities' systems work.
Mm-hmm.
And Metro is pretty, but what isn't pretty is its safety record right now. And I think that is the problematic issue.
That last real quick point here, Hal. Until folks in the D.C. region stop viewing Metro as just, oh, it's a system for mostly low-income black people. Let's be real. I mean, then you're going to get the kinds of investments that you want. But that's the perception right now, that it's a system that mostly poor, working-class black folks use. You know, and that's the problem with most mass transit systems. We have that problem in Philly, too. We just had a couple of days ago in Philly, a girl got raped on an elevated SEPTA L system.
Yeah.
So and while people are watching, and that also there needs to be a conversation about the perceptions of mass transit systems and why they keep getting woefully underfunded.
Misha, real quick before I take a break.
No, Charles, I was going to say the same thing. You're right on point. But the Philly incident in particular was horrifying because it was recorded. But I think you're right. The stigma regarding Metro and the fact that it's for low-income people, particularly here, is what folks think. And that's not the case. I think until we see our leaders taking Metro, I think until we see the Ramada folks taking Metro, I think until that happens, like as we see in places like Chicago, Philadelphia, and of course the mayor of New York famously takes the subway every day, I think until that happens, the stigma surrounding Metro being for people who don't have access to anything else will be there, and that no one will care and put the correct funding necessary for it.
Barbara from Capitol Heights, do not hang up. We are going to talk to you next. You will be able to hear the program when I hear what you have to say. We are at the Reporters Roundtable talking about some of the top stories of the week, and we have some doozies for you as always. We're going to take a break, but we'll be back in just a bit. Don't forget, you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast on WHUR.com. Download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. If you're on the phone, hang on. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. I'm Harold Fisher. Stretches in for John Mons, and he's next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll be back in just a few seconds. Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM, channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. I'm Harold Fisher. We are at the Reporters Roundtable with the top stories of the week, and there is plenty to talk about. My guests are Charles Ellison, political commentator and editor of The B-Note, and Misha Green, D.C. editor of the Afro-American Newspapers. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Barbara, calling from Capitol Heights, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I just want to say, I don't understand why this is such a big surprise to people. Metro been doing foul stuff from, I know, at least 20-some years back. And since I stopped riding the public transportation because I got just really disgusted with the system some 20 years ago. And like you said, of all the issues that they are having, and they constantly jacking up the prices just to cover up or to recoup some of the money that they are losing in the losses that they are getting. And yes, I would love to see a major, massive overhaul in higher up employees, because they're just coming in just to get attacked. They don't care about what happens, who gets hurt. And it's sad. It is really a tragedy.
Yeah. Yeah. Barbara, thank you so much for your input. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Don, calling from Chicago. Thanks for calling, Don. What's on your mind?
What's on my mind? I kind of took offense with them making a statement that Mass Transit was viewed as a poor people's mode of transportation. Being a native Chicagoan, Mass Transit is used by the white folks in the northern suburbs, the southern suburbs. The white folks in Indiana take Mass Transit into Chicago. Now, we do have some problems, but, you know, for the most part, it's safe, it's effective, it's on time, and it's efficient. I rode DC Mass Transit once, but twice, and both times the trains broke down. I will never ride DC Transit again, and I've been here 8 years.
All right, Don. Thank you so much.
If I could, real quick, Harold. Sure. You know, like, I think that, he should be offended by me saying that. But you know what? That is the perception. I'm not saying I believe that. And I love mass transit. I'll be the first to tell you, I hate driving. I grew up a block away from a subway station and a regional rail line station and a few blocks away from a mass metro transit center. So I love mass transit. But that is the perception. And, you know, Chicago's having that same issue, too, as are other mass transit agencies, especially through pandemic, underfunding. And why aren't they getting funding from their federal or state policymakers and even some local? It's because of that perception. And I think, yeah, people need to be outraged and offended by that perception and make sure we get the correct levels of investment in mass transit.
Let's move on to another topic, although if you want to call in and go back to Metro or any of the other topics we're talking about tonight, please feel free. Okay, Misha, one of the things that we are seeing this year is a lot of police shootings. 14 people shot by DC police this year, five of them deadly shootings. And that was just in this year so far. Last year, six people shot, two people killed. Now, what's going on? Do we take these things in its totality? Are police officers getting into more scrapes? Are the situations more deadly? What's your take on this? I mean, even the situation with 30-year-old DeAndre Johnson on Monday in Southeast, a 30-year-old man who allegedly reached for an officer's sidearm and he was shot. There are still a lot of questions about that shooting.
Yeah, I think the one thing that I don't understand is why there are questions around that shooting. When it first happened, everything that Chief Conte said was that there's still very little information known and they need to do more investigation. And then, of course, as reporters, we know that's the language they use, right? But we have police cameras. We have footage everywhere. There were folks who have recorded that incident, allegedly, and said that it didn't go down the way it's being reported. I just really wish that someone could explain to me why we're even having these sorts of conversations when everyone is supposed to have a police camera that can get such footage, that can help explain what's going on. But I think the overall issue is that we're still having police shootings. At the end of the day, police officers are, I am very aware, in an unsafe or dangerous position, but they are the ones armed generally. And we spent all of 2020 protesting about it for the most part. Continued in 2021. We're in the middle right now of jury selection for Ahmaud Arbery. We saw George Floyd's killer incarcerated. I don't understand why police officers at this juncture are reaching for deadly weapons as the first form of apprehending someone. The shooting that happened on the 1300 block of Congress Street Southeast started because they were going to serve someone a temporary protection order.
Yeah.
So it just does not make sense to me that it's escalated in that way. I think that it's yet another sign that we need true community police, those community police officers who are trusted, who are not seen as a threat if they're doing something such as serving a temporary protection order. They're still so much lack of trust, particularly in that neighborhood, because of shootings and murders such as Caron Hilton. I was really disappointed to hear sort of the language and rhetoric surrounding the particular shooting on Monday. And MPD is in a lot of hot water right now. With the 10 women who have come out based off of issues of assault and racism and
sexual harassment
and punitive actions for saying for speaking up and saying that there are issues. I'm really concerned about what's happening with the MPD right now.
Charles, your thoughts about it?
Yeah, rather than using the big moment that we all went through, that we all saw since last year, as an opportunity to have a direct conversation with the public about, okay, well, how can we achieve better policing? You saw a lot of police and police unions especially, because police unions are like a big part of the problem.
And you know, police are all in their feelings and you know, and taking it personally that people want to hold them accountable. Well, no, you know, you're the ones, just like Misha said, you're the ones who are armed. And a lot of the, most of these situations, the citizens aren't armed. So, you know, we've got to get into, you know, ask them, like, why didn't you want to sit down at the table and why didn't you want to have a conversation about an accountability infrastructure that needs to be in place for a major city police department like MPD? Another thing is that we need to really examine very closely about who's running police departments, especially big city or local police departments. Is it the mayors and the police chiefs, or is it the police unions? So, because we're having that problem in a lot of major cities, whether it's New York or Philly, it seems like the police union chiefs are the ones running local police departments. And last I checked, that's illegal. So, you know, that needs to be looked in deeply. Another thing, too, is that a lot of us in the community, you know, we spent so much time focusing on, you know, things like, you know, big, really controversial political debates like defund the police. Now, we need to talk about purging the police. That's the priority, because you can defund all you want. But if you got the same racist knuckleheads or white nationalist knuckleheads, you know, infecting those police departments, they're still there. So, you know, we haven't had a conversation about, you know, you can train all you want too, but we need to have a conversation about screening, hiring of white nationalists or people with the types of sentiments that, you know, they have very hostile, very vicious, racist attitudes towards the communities or the type of people that they patrol. See, that's what we really need to be doing, is purging police departments of these types of infectious attitudes, racist attitudes, that lead to these kinds of these calamities. That should, Misha's right. Like, we went through a whole year of this, a big conversation. It should have calmed down. You know, but lastly too, it's we're going to have to strike a balance though, because, you know, just like in every other major city, homicides and gun shootings, non-fatal, are very high in D.C. So, you know, folks are going to have to strike that balance too in that conversation between, yeah, you know, making sure police are policing better, but also making sure that we're getting optimal public safety in major cities, like whether it's D.C., Baltimore, or Philly, or wherever.
Well, here's my concern, and looking, you know, more broadly in the DeAndre Johnson issue, I would imagine. And I don't know, but he was accused of putting a gun to the head of the mother of his child 2 days prior, which is why the temporary protective order was there. That's a separate incident from what police say happened on Monday. Did police suspect that he may have been dangerous? They may have. But as far as we know on Monday, he was not armed. The police say that one of the officers say he reached for the weapon. But again, there is so much that we don't know. And to Misha's point, yes, there are cameras, but we have seen time and time again over the years that even with cameras, the cameras are imperfect tools. We don't see everything, and that works both for and against the police. And I think that, that's one of the other problems. But then we go back to August, Misha, and we look at the shooting of Antoine Gilmore on New York Avenue. There are still a lot of questions about that shooting, that early morning shooting in New York and Florida, as to why shots were fired. The reporting is that he was asleep in his car just before 3 o'clock in the morning. And there were questions about why, you know, the officer shot him. There are questions about, was there a gun in the car, or there was a gun in the car, but it wasn't pointed. It was on the seat. Was it in the lap? There were just so many questions that again raise uncertainty about about this extremely dangerous job for the police. And again, the relationship between the police and the community, as you raised earlier.
Absolutely. And I think the Antoine Gilmore case is a really perfect example, really sad, but perfect example surrounding the fact that we learn far more information from the public. If you recall, of course, there was police footage released from body camera footage, I should say, released mm-hmm. from the Antoine Gilmore shooting that shows that Gilmore must have been somewhat startled, and then the shooting occurred. But if you remember, there was a young woman who instinctually saw what was going on and pulled out her phone, and so much more information was revealed. And did they really even attempt to really wake up Antoine before it happened, and those sorts of things that were far more revealed post his shooting and post, of course, what the MPD said. And of course, we know it. I mean, it's not like the police are the only organization that tries to cover their behinds when things happen. But we are not going to get further when it's those that are supposed to protect and serve that are killing in a far, I think, disparate way, black people.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a quandary, and in some cases a mystery, and a difficult one. I don't think that we are going to be able to solve in this conversation. I do want to move on to a bit of a political quandary right now, and this redistricting controversy in Prince George's County, and it is a hyper local issue, but this really is about, my vote, your vote, where will my vote count? Who will I be voting for? And I think, you know, they say all politics are local, but that, you know, that issue, Charles, is really, really big. And the bottom line is that a panel has recommended redistricting for one of Prince George's County's districts, particularly College Park.
Yeah.
And people are upset about it. And there is going to be a public hearing starting, it's going to be next month. It's going to be in November. But, you know, I'm surprised folks didn't show up with pitchforks and torches. Mm-hmm. You know, earlier this week, people are not happy about this, and a lot of has to do with growing and shifting populations, and this is happening around the University of Maryland as well, which is a huge population center. And no matter where it happens, if you are a person who cares about your vote and you're used to voting in one district and now those things are shifting, right, it is going to at least make you uncomfortable.
It is. I'm not surprised that, you know, you're suddenly having this big, you know, kind of spurt of outrage over, you know, this redistricting map in Prince George's County. I'm never surprised when you see, like, this outreach happen after any, you know, major redistricting scuffle. On a more local level or state or even when we talk about like congressional districts, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's never surprising because, you know, I was just interviewing Attorney General Eric Holder today. He's chairman of the Democratic Redistricting Committee, and we talked about how, you know, generally speaking, the public does not know about, you know, very sophisticated terms like redistricting. They're not familiar with how important it is.
It's not sexy.
It's not sexy, but it's one of the just more impactful and consequential aspects of the political process and policy making. I mean, it impacts everything in our lives, you know, the way districts are configured, how they're drawn up. And, you know, pox on the Prince George's County Council, you know, for not being transparent. So it's really funny, too. It's really hilarious how, you know, county council members are fussing about how, oh,
You know, like, you know, Councilman Davis says his map, this wasn't transparent. This is not what we agreed to. It's like, well, y'all not being transparent to the public, to your constituents about this process. Like, once we start finding out, and I'm a resident of Prince George's County, we find out when we're like, you know, we open up the Washington Post or some other local news, but, oh, they were going through a redistricting round. You know, so it's like they've got to, you have this constant disconnect between the folks at the grass tops. And let's be real, you know, they do things in a very secretive and non-transparent manner. And then finally, you know, get a reporter who finally reports on it, puts it out there, and they act like, oh, you know, we were trying to be transparent all along. No, you weren't. You know, so if you were, you wouldn't have this much outrage and much anger when the results come out. And so they've got to do a better job, and this has always been the issue with local, especially Prince George's County or PG County politics, is this constant disconnect, and it's accepted as a norm, a standard, a disconnect between the grass tops elected class folks and the grassroots residential folks who don't know what these folks in county council do, or who don't know what happens in Annapolis. They don't find out until after the fact, and that has to stop.
I think this public hearing is going to be muscular. It's going to be energetic. It's going to be lit. As the young folks say, that's for you, Misha. And you know, and I would imagine that there probably isn't going to be a whole lot of movement from where they are now to the proposal by the three-person redistricting commission, because these people are ticked off, Misha. They really are.
They really are, and I think it really goes back to Charles' point about a lack of transparency. I mean, we know, because we're informed, right, that redistricting happens after a certain amount of years, and it's generally post the census. Well, there was so much push and so many people collaborating to ensure that folks, particularly in Prince George's County, right?
Yeah, participating in the census. Yep.
Right? And so, but people didn't really understand why, right? And right. So at least they knew what the implications were, right? Other than, which are, and these are important things, right? Such as having bus stops available for folks and things like that, right? But if people really understood all of the implications that come with filling out that census and redistricting being a major piece of it, I think there would not, people wouldn't be as angry as they are right now. But then you have Councilmember Davis, who admitted to only sharing some of the preview of the map with only a few of his colleagues, enough to form the bare majority. And so this hush-hush nature, this lack of transparency, this way of getting stuff done just to sort of move to the next level, it is not how we're going to get Prince George's County residents on board. Prince George's County is not about that. The folks are active, and the people want to feel part of the political process. So as you said, I think that this public hearing is going to be lit.
Thank you. Never have I felt more hip when I'm talking to you. Yeah, but I agree, and I think that, you know, transparency is the word. And as much as we expect it or demand it from politicians, I think that is something that we cannot always expect. And perhaps this is a prime example. We will have to wait and see. Finally tonight. The passing of Colin Powell, huge news this week. You know, dying from complications of, you know, of COVID, a soldier, a history maker, a giant public servant. Charles, I tell you. I felt that. I really did.
Yeah. It's, you know, there's a lot that hit hard, you know, for a lot of us, you know, who kind of basically grew up with General Powell, right? You know, we did. We grew up with that generation that grew up with General Powell, so he's like one of those icons, even though he's got that problematic legacy with the Iraq War, the invasion of Iraq by U.S. that he even admitted. He's like, he acknowledged, you know, that it was just so wrong, and I'll never be able to, you know, fully atone for that. I will say this, though. I think it's a bit of journalistic malfeasance, the headlines coming out of how Colin Powell died, and, you know, it just real shadiness from his publicist who, you know, put that out there that he died from COVID-19. He had blood cancer. He died from blood cancer. He died from multiple myeloma and also was dealing with Parkinson's disease. It's like a very vicious form of cancer. Multiple myeloma. And then, you know, his immune system was already beat up. And then here comes COVID, you know, and that didn't help, obviously. But it's, you know, I feel like his publicist must have had some sort of agenda, like an anti-vax agenda. And we've had this conversation before. So you had a lot of people grabbing onto that as an excuse for while they're doing their air quotes research. You know, which they're not doing, to say, oh, see, he got vaccinated. No, he was 84 years old, and he was battling blood cancer. And really, the lead headline should be, Colin Powell died from blood cancer, from multiple myeloma.
With a weakened immune system, an immune system that was already weakened.
Right. That has to be clarified, because people are out there running with that, you know, people who have been opposed to vaccine, especially a lot of black folks out there still. And at the end of the day, you know, you get vaccinated, you don't end up in the hospital and you don't die. But, you know, people are still convinced, or doing their research, convinced that there's something wrong with this vaccine, which I don't understand, because we grew up getting vaccines. We wouldn't have lived as long. We wouldn't be here on this phone if we hadn't gotten vaccinated as kids. So suddenly vaccines are like a bad thing. And so, you know, it's terrible that his legacy or his death, his transition, was marred by that.
I agree 100% with you, and it really is unfortunate. But I think that, you know, his story is so much bigger even than his death. And it is truly an American story, I will say. And Misha, I don't know about your perspective, but I think it goes to the point where, you know, as a soldier, you didn't know what his politics were until you knew what his politics were. Even as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I didn't know that he was a Republican. And it wasn't until after he retired and he came out as a Republican, I was like, oh, okay. But he was a different kind of Republican. He was what you might consider one of the so-called old school Republicans, having worked for a Democrat and Republican presidents. And just really just played it right down the line. And of course, speaking out against Donald Trump and supporting Barack Obama in his run for president, he was an incredible, incredible man.
Absolutely. You know, so Colin Powell actually did not, I think, declare that he was Republican until 1993. And I think that was purposeful, because first and foremost, he was a soldier. We've heard all the stories about people saying, should I address you as Secretary of State?
Yeah.
Secretary of State. And he says, no, call me general, because I'm a soldier always and forever. And like you said, you know, I don't know if I can attest to old school Republican or not. Admittedly. But I do know that he was a man who went with his truth, first and foremost. And so while his truth sometimes was controversial, you know, he's obviously apologized for the sort of mess that was his UN speech regarding the weapons of mass destruction. But there's been so much in his death that I've learned, such as that he thought President Bush, W, tooth and nail about invading Iraq, and said that this would be his war and his mess. And, you know, I was 13 in 2004 when he resigned. So, you know, I don't remember sort of everything surrounding it. But I thought at that time, I can remember thinking, oh, well, that was a bold move, General Powell, even then. And, of course, his support of Obama in 2008 and 2012, it shows that this man was not necessarily politically a Republican as much as politically a man that went with his gut, did a lot of research, and stood for what he believed was right. I mean, when he supported Obama in 2008, it was because he was disgusted by the divisive language that John McCain had during his campaign and all of the accusations of the Republican Party and calling Obama a Muslim.
Yeah.
And he came out and said, well, what if he's Christian, but what if he was a Muslim? What would the problem be? He's an American. It's a great loss for us and really a great loss, I think, for the media, because he was the guy that always told the truth.
Yeah, there you go. Misha Green, Charles Ellison, thank you both for talking to me again tonight. I appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks again, Harold.
All right.
Thanks.
That is the Daily Drum for this Wednesday, October 20th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.